The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, my head feels a lot better today, but my voice, it sounds terrible as I listen to myself in the headphones here. You're just going to have to put up with a very nasal-sounding presentation today. But be assured that I do feel much better, and I do appreciate Richard Palmer filling in for me yesterday, just covering some quite a lot of important stories, and there will be some overlap with what we discuss here in the first segment. So I appreciate him coming in at the last minute, by the way, but he's certainly up to the task when that does happen, because he really is immersed into the news and is very helpful for me and for Brad McDonald and as you know, for the Trumpet Magazine and the website. So it was great listening to him again yesterday. Well, he referred, if you heard there, he referred to the strong response that we got on the Key of David this past weekend. He mentioned it, I think, at the end of his show yesterday. And it was a strong response. The title of the program was Your Time is Your Life. And as Richard pointed out to me over the weekend, typically when we have programs that talk about, well, we need to make changes, or we need to do this to improve our lives, that those typically don't get as many responses as the ones on prophecy or other subjects that aren't really, let's say, corrective. In any event, this one brought in 186 total requests for the Last Hour book and also the little booklet, The Seven Laws of Success, which, as Richard noted yesterday, is one of the more popular booklets that Herbert Armstrong ever produced. So 186 responses or requests for those booklets, that makes this past weekend's program right now the 10th most responsive program yet, and it's likely going to move up to 9th or possibly even 8th on the top 10 list following the week ahead with all the residual calls that come in. It's also, I think, worth noting that this past weekend, all around the world, was Easter. And I know Andrew Locher told me that the program in the States took a little bit of a hit because of the holiday. So I think when you add to that that it was a holiday weekend, and here in the UK, we moved the clocks forward. So the program actually came on an hour earlier, at least on the Sunday plays. We had the Saturday morning play as usual. But with the clocks moving forward, essentially, you had the program playing an hour earlier, and yet despite that, and the fact that it was a holiday weekend, it still is going to turn out to be our 8th or 9th highest program ever. So some really exciting responses that we've been getting these last few weeks. You'll recall last week we advertised the pagan holidays or God's holy days, which that booklet that brought in 175 requests, that was a repeat program, by the way, from one that we played last year at about this time, 175 for that. And then, of course, 2 weeks ago, the all-time record, as it now is, 266 total requests for He Was Right and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. So all total, these last 3 weekends have brought in 627 requests for literature. Andrew Locher told me yesterday that we crossed the 2,000 request mark just after the first 3 months of this year. 2,000 total requests so far this year. That's for all the literature that we've offered on the Key of David in the UK. And he said to me that last year, this is Andrew Locher, he said last year it took us until the end of July to cross the 2,000 mark. So we're on quite a pace. Certainly outperforming. Now, we do have a couple of stations that we added in July last year, so it was a lot slower going out of the starting gate last year, but to be really on double the pace even more so than that. That's pretty exciting news. Well, as I mentioned yesterday, Richard did a great job of summarizing some of the more recent events, in particular, some of the terrorist attacks. It's just been a brutal week over the past 7-8 days, starting with the attack in Brussels that left, I think it's now 35 that have died as a result of that attack. And following that one, there have been a number of other ones since. But following that attack, the State Department in the United States released a travel alert for Americans traveling to Europe. It said terrorist groups continue to plan near-term attacks throughout Europe, targeting sporting events, tourist sites, restaurants, and transportation. It says this travel alert expires on June 20th, 2016. So you have April, May, June, a three-month period that Americans are being advised. Be alert if you're going to travel to Europe. There's more attacks coming. That one in Brussels was last Tuesday, as I think you know. And then there was a less reported incident in Glasgow, you might have seen. This was on Thursday last week. This Muslim shopkeeper who was murdered by a fellow Muslim after this shopkeeper wished Christians a happy Easter. He did this in a social media post. He's a Muslim, and he's reaching out to the Christian community. He says to them, happy Easter. And this is a voice that had previously spoken out against extremism. And how did his friends or associates respond? Well, they killed him. They killed him. This happened in Glasgow, where I happened to be last week myself, in Scotland. That was on Thursday. Then on Friday, you barely heard anything about this one because it's been overshadowed by some of these other reports, by some of these other horrific attacks. There was a suicide bomb attack at a soccer match in Iraq. That was on Friday. That killed 41 people. A soccer game where people went to have a good time, to have some fun. Families, women, children. On that same day, the Islamic State crucified a 56-year-old Indian Catholic priest. Richard mentioned this yesterday. There had been reports about this or rumors that this was going to take place, and sure enough, at least from what we can gather, it did. That was on Friday. He was kidnapped in Yemen. This state pretty much taken over by Iran. There were 3 explosions in Yemen on Friday, by the way, that left 25 people dead. 25 people dead. And then, of course, there was Pakistan on Sunday. A massive suicide blast that went right after Christian families celebrating Easter. And most of the casualties, women and children, little children. It happened at a playground. That was Sunday, just the other day. Let me play for you how the U.S. State Department, the spokesman here is John Kirby, and this is how he responded to that attack. He's basically repeating the official statement that was released on Sunday, and this is spokesman John Kirby yesterday morning.
I think you may have seen our statement yesterday on the terrorist attack in Lahore, but I do want to reiterate it here today that we condemn in the strongest terms the appalling terrorist attack in the Gulshan-e-Iqbal Park in Lahore that killed dozens and left scores injured, and many of them were children, as I think you saw. The United States stands with the people and government of Pakistan at this very difficult hour, and we send our deepest condolences to the loved ones of those killed and, of course, to all those injured. We are praying for a speedy recovery.
Those are the strongest terms that the State Department could put forward. Commentary Magazine talked about that in a post just yesterday. I'll go through this, or at least portions of it, later on in this segment. But at no point in this statement released by the State Department did it mention the identity of the victims, that they were Christians, in other words. It didn't note that the terrorist organization behind it had previously had ties with the Islamic State. And commentary asked this, what logic would lead the State Department to omit these details, which fully explain the attack's motivation, but for the presumption that to use precise language in this case is ultimately counterproductive? We've been hearing a lot from spokesmen, from officials in the Obama administration, about how counterproductive it is to specifically assign blame. And so when they come out with the strongest terms to condemn the attack, they talk about the dozens that were killed, the scores that were injured, and how that their prayers are with those that are recovering, with those who lost loved ones. But like commentary brings out, what logic would lead the State Department to omit the details that fully explain the attack and the motivation behind it? And the fact that these were radical Islamists that were targeting Christians, that wanted to kill Christians, children, women. It's the same refrain every time we see one of these attacks. To call them out, to call out the radical Islamists, to do it with specificity, well, that would be counterproductive. Let me play a clip for you from President Obama. This is following the attacks from Belgium last week and before what happened on Sunday in Pakistan. This is from his weekly address on Saturday.
As we move forward in this fight, we have to wield another weapon alongside our airstrikes, our military, and our counterterrorism work, and our diplomacy. And that's the power of our example. Our openness to refugees fleeing ISIL's violence, our determination to win the battle against ISIL's hateful and violent propaganda, a distorted view of Islam that aims to radicalize young Muslims to their cause. In that effort, our most important partners are American Muslims. That's why we have to reject any attempt to stigmatize Muslim Americans and their enormous contributions to our country and our way of life. Such attempts are contrary to our character, to our values, and to our history as a nation built around the idea of religious freedom. It's also counterproductive. It plays right into the hands of terrorists who want to turn us against one another, who need a reason to recruit more people to their hateful cause.
Counterproductive, as you heard there. So this is the weapon that we've got to use. We've got to guard against Islamophobia. He comes right out, right after a deadly attack, another deadly attack in the heart of Europe. And he cautions all Americans, he cautions Westerners to make sure that you don't specifically identify the enemy or the threat. Did you know that over the past month there have been at least 130 terrorist attacks in 25 different nations? Over 1,100 people have been murdered. More than 3,000 people have been injured. That's just in 30 days. That's just over the course of March for the most part. And yet after each one of these attacks, certainly after the major ones, Westerners are repeatedly told that the real danger here is Islamophobia. The real danger here is lashing back or fighting back, even with strong terms. Mr. Kirby said yesterday, we condemn in the strongest terms the appalling terrorist attack. And then what followed was about as weak of a statement as you could read. As Commentary Magazine noted, that the average cease and desist letter is more strongly worded. But this has become the norm. And of course, it's not even based in in facts, these arguments that, well, to say this or to say that is wrong. It's counterproductive because we've got to try to tamp down the rhetoric so that the spread of Islamophobia can be stopped. And in fact, if you look at least with respect to the United States, I don't have stats for Europe, but FBI statistics show that 57% of hate crimes in the U.S. are aimed at Jews, and only 16% are aimed at Muslims. 57% are aimed at Jews, and yet look at how many lectures we receive from the left about hate crimes or about Islamophobia. There is no rampant Islamophobia in America. It doesn't exist. You may have seen reports, I believe this was from Saturday. Well, no, let me just go back. I'll get to this this protest that was canceled in just a moment. But just looking at the reaction from John Kirby and from President Obama, it's very similar to many of the leaders in Europe as well. There was a piece in the New York Post on Sunday, I believe, by Amir Tahriri, who says that Brussels is what happens when liberals don't push immigrants to integrate. We talked previously last week about Molenbeek, the part of Brussels that is pretty much all Islamic. And it says here that after the attack last Tuesday, which killed 35 people, it says the European Union's foreign policy representative, the Italian Federica Mogherini, she happened to be on an official visit in Jordan. And the Post here reports, fighting back tears, she cut short a news conference saying, "It's a very sad day for Europe, as Europe and its capital are suffering the same pain that the Middle East has known and knows every single day, be it in Syria, be it elsewhere." She then mused, this is the New York Post, she then mused about the role that Islam may have played in the tragedy, dismissing the idea of a clash between Islam and the West. "Islam," she said, "holds a place in our Western societies. Islam belongs to Europe. I'm not afraid to say that political Islam should be part of the picture." So it's not just a religion now. It's a political movement. It's a political ideology. And it's very much part of the European picture, she says. I mean, this is the European Union's foreign policy representative. It says Mogherini's statement offers an insight into the mentality that has helped produce the situation in Western European societies, where fear is woven into the fabric of daily life. It's a world of illusions and false identities. In Mogherini's world, the sufferings of Syrians caused by a savage regime are on par with the sufferings of the inhabitants of European capital cities, such as Madrid, London, Paris, and now Brussels, that have come under attack from jihadists who kill at random. She says finally, or actually this is by a man, the article. It says, "In that world, political Islam, far from being an adversary dedicated to your destruction, becomes part of the family." The envoy fails to see the logical conclusion of her analysis. If Islam is no longer a religion but a political ideology, why shouldn't it be subjected to the same treatment, including criticism, as any other political ideology? And if it poses a present and clear danger, face outright suppression. He's pointing out here that's what would happen in other circumstances, perhaps involving a right-wing party, a left-wing party. And yet, where are the denunciations of this so-called political ideology that happens to be producing so many radicals, radicals by the thousands, and surveys that keep coming out showing that there's quite a lot of sympathy, even for those that commit these atrocities, particularly when you look at the numbers of Muslims around the world. You take 8, 10, 12, 15% that are sympathetic to these, to using violence, like what happened in Pakistan, this suicide bomber driving his truck right into the middle of this little playground with children, women and children. After Belgium last week, the attacks there, Ted Cruz, the Republican candidate, he issued a statement calling on securing the borders and empowering law enforcement to, as he said, patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. Mr. Cruz said, for years, the West has tried to deny this enemy exists out of a combination of political correctness and fear. We can no longer afford either. Our European allies are now seeing what comes of a toxic mix of migrants who've been infiltrated by terrorists in isolated radical Muslim neighborhoods. He said, we need to immediately halt the flow of refugees from countries with a significant Al-Qaeda or ISIS presence. And then he said about the law enforcement that we need to empower them to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. Now, you know how those on the left responded to that position, to that statement? Well, they said it was Ted Cruz's words that are dangerous. That's what Hillary Clinton said. Those are dangerous words. Secretary of State Kerry was out there saying, this is an embarrassment what these men are saying. Secure the borders and empower law enforcement to patrol Muslim neighborhoods? This is crazy. This is outlandish. This is dangerous rhetoric. Notice this statement from President Obama himself. This is from his trip to Argentina during a presser last week.
Any approach that would single them out or target them for discrimination is not only wrong and un-American, but it also would be counterproductive because it would reduce the strength, the antibodies that we have to resist terrorism. And that is how we are going to defeat these terrorist groups. In part because we're going after them and taking strikes against them and arresting them and getting intelligence on them and cooperating with other countries. But a lot of it is also going to be to say, you do not have power over us. We are strong. Our values are right. You offer nothing.
You offer nothing. You heard there again, the counterproductive to actually single anyone out or any movement out or any neighborhood out. To do that would be counterproductive. And then he went on in that same press conference to single out Ted Cruz. Listen to this.
As far as the notion of having surveillance of neighborhoods where Muslims are present, I just left a country that engages in that kind of neighborhood surveillance, which, by the way, the father of Senator Cruz escaped for America, the land of the free. The notion that we would start down that slippery slope makes absolutely no sense. It's contrary to who we are. And it's not going to help us defeat ISIL.
So it's fine. It's fine, of course, to single out Republicans, to single out Ted Cruz or Donald Trump for this supposedly dangerous rhetoric about closing borders and ramping up police patrols in Muslim neighborhoods. But when a Muslim terrorist blows up Christian women and children on a playground in Pakistan on Easter, well, we've got to be very careful. Don't you know? We've got to be very careful not to specify who was really behind it. And we certainly don't want to point out that they were Christian, because that would then get to motivation. And we've got to make sure that we avoid that kind of talk. Because if we do, get into it, if we do point out who's to blame, if we get into the motivation, well, that's just going to make it easier for ISIS and other groups to get more recruits. That's what so many people firmly believe. So many people leading Western nations firmly believe. And you see it over and over again, this thinking in those speeches. There was a piece in the Daily Mail about this protest, or march, I guess it was, that was scheduled for Saturday or Sunday in Brussels. And then it was canceled. This lady here writes in her, Katie Hopkins, she writes in her article, the real threat is not the far right, it's the smug left. And then she says, so let's get this straight. She's writing about this march that was canceled. Let's get this straight. A peace march in Belgium was canceled over fears ISIS could use it to launch another attack on Brussels. Belgium security forces decided a march against fear, however topical, would be ill-advised because the fear is grounded in truth and marching isn't going to make it go away. This is a bit like the people who say they're standing up to terror by continuing to use the underground. They're not actually standing up to anything. There's no real show of defiance. Everyone's scared to death. I mean, that's the reality. People in the capital cities of Europe are afraid about when the next terrorist attack will happen. She says, in truth, they're gambling on the old adage, lightning never strikes the same spot twice. Or for a more modern twist, suicide bombers never target the same subway twice in a week. But if you live in Jihadi Central, that's a pretty risky bet to place. That's what Molenbeek has turned into. It's Jihadi Central. And we don't want to increase patrols through those neighborhoods. Not at all. And so more and more jihadis flock to those neighborhoods, those places of refuge. And the problems intensify. And we know it's building to a spectacular clash. It says here, finally, as far as I can tell, the march against fear was canceled because there was too much fear. And a riot broke out because the police objected to a peaceful protest. And so that's what's happening. Wherever you see a stand, a defiant stand even, Western officials are quick to be on the spot to say, hey, don't use that dangerous language. Don't identify the perpetrator. Don't talk about motivation. Just pretend these things, well, they just don't really exist or they don't really matter. And let's try to make nice. Let's try to reach out. Is it working? Over the past month, there's been over 130 terrorist attacks in 25 nations. And we're here to tell you that it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse, and in large part because of this kind of strategy. Now, eventually, as we know from Daniel 11, Europe's going to take on a new and different strategy, a much stronger, bolder stance against this aggression, against this push. But not the United States. This commentary piece that I mentioned by Noah Rothman, he says it takes a desperate commitment to ambiguity and moral equivalence to avoid calling the unspeakable terror meted out to the members of a tiny Christian minority in predominantly Muslim Pakistan out for precisely what it is. But America's diplomatic establishment specializes in such obfuscation. I mean, it takes a desperate commitment to ambiguity That's exactly what we see coming out of the State Department, coming out of the White House, coming out of Brussels, coming out of the EU. Hear an attack, this one in Pakistan, that the U.S. condemned supposedly in the strongest terms, without drawing attention to the terrorist organization behind it, or that it was motivated by a desire to kill Christians, to slaughter women and children who were celebrating Easter. Rothman says here, the prevailing contention is that calling radical Islamic terrorism, makes combating this phenomenon harder. It says, if the Muslim world is so delicate that it will shatter at the mere mention of the fact that there is a cancer within their midst, then so be it. Condemning the ideology that leads misguided young men to murder innocent children due to their religious affiliation is not so much to ask, is it? This is not so much to ask. What's fueling this? What's the ideology behind it? Why do these atrocities keep happening? This piece quotes from Hillary Clinton, what she said back in November in response to the attack in Paris, the multiple attacks in Paris killed hundreds just a few months ago. And Mrs. Clinton said the obsession in some quarters with a clash of civilization or repeating the specific words radical Islamic terrorism isn't just a distraction. It gives these criminals, these murderers, more standing than they deserve. And so we can't do that. That's the thinking. We can't give them more standing than they deserve. And so we've just got to whitewash it. But as Rothman points out in this commentary piece, Mrs. Clinton has had harsher things to say about Republicans. It's Ted Cruz that has the dangerous rhetoric. It's what Ted Cruz said that's dangerous, you see. What a world. You think this is going to solve the problem? Well, thankfully, we know what the Bible says about where this is headed. One last bit from commentary. It says, the left-wing tenet, which bizarrely posits that calling radical Islamic terrorists who target Christian children for death on their holiest of holidays somehow plays right into the terrorist hands, is deeply flawed. The suggestion that men of good faith within the Muslim world would be moved to support child killers because they feel slighted by the State Department is the height of condescension and, yes, Western chauvinism. You see what he's saying there. To say that if the State Department just came out with actual strong terms, that it would cause more Muslims to join on with killing little children in a playground? It's just bizarre. And yet that's what so many firmly believe. Let me just repeat for you what we read last week and what we've read many weeks and months on this program. What it says in Daniel 11 and verse 40. I mean, you can see by the thinking in some of these Western officials and leaders, you can see why America is, there's large numbers of people turning out to support politically incorrect firebrands like Donald Trump. And can you see how that's going to happen in the heart of Europe as well? Europe's going to go through a radical transformation, that's for sure. And a strong man's going to emerge out of the heart of Europe with the full support and encouragement and admonition coming from the Vatican in Rome. Well, Daniel 11 and verse 40 shows us that while this spirit of nationalism might be strong right now all across Europe. I mean, the rise of nationalism and even in the United States. The road ahead for Europe and for the United States is very different, actually. Donald Trump, or anyone else for that matter, is not going to solve this problem. But it will be confronted. It will be confronted by a downsized European Union. 10 nations, 10 kings, led by a strong man. Verse 40 says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him, the king of the south, like a whirlwind. Now, we identified the king of the south 20-some years ago. Herbert Armstrong identified the king of the north decades before that. A European combine coming against radical Islam, the king of the south. And as we've noted, my father did back a few years ago, the United States, Britain, and these are the descendants of ancient Israel, the United States and Britain, they're nowhere mentioned. They're nowhere mentioned. And so, as I say, it may appear that the leftist leaders in Europe and in the United States are taking both regions on a similar path and a similar journey. But they are going to take a turn, a different turn, the United States, compared to Europe, when we finally see Daniel 2, Daniel 8, Revelation 17, Revelation 13, these prophecies being fulfilled. You can see with one, this past week, there's been one push after another push after another push. And it's building to this clash. This clash prophesied in Daniel 11 and verse 40. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream's available at thetrumpet.com and at the KPCG website as well. Keep sending us those emails. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, my voice is holding up well enough, I guess. It sounds terrible, but I've still got some vocals, so we had some audio queued up just in case we needed to finish the program with that. But with just 10, 15 minutes left, I'll go ahead and push to the finish line. We taped a program last week. It was kind of built on a radio show we did a few weeks ago, if you remember us talking about that London Expo with all of that technology and those filmmakers and directors and cinematographers. And I commented about just the technology, this awesome progress that we see all over the world, the Western world in particular. And yet, as I just described to you in segment one, it's also a world full of appalling evil. of things like, leave aside the terrorism, the hundreds and hundreds of instances each year that play out, terrorist acts. But you add to that illiteracy and disease, the abject poverty. You add to that the family breakdown all across our society. How could a world with such mind-staggering progress, how could it also accommodate so much evil and suffering? How do you explain this paradox that Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, so often talked about? The fact that in the midst of all this technology, all this advancement, we've got the very best of our societies, the very best human minds, that while they can produce all of these push-button technologies, they can't solve the most basic problems of family life or peace between nations, between religions. Let's begin over in Hosea chapter 4, the prophet Hosea. This is a passage, too, that we read often. It says a lot about where we are today, why we are where we are. The book of Hosea, chapter 4 and verse 6. It says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you. And you shall be no priest to me, seeing you have forgotten the law of God. I will also forget your children. Our children, you see, they won't be protected because of our forgetfulness, because of us forgetting God's law. Verse 7 says, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. That's Hosea 4. And verse 7, look at what's wrong. Something's dreadfully wrong with the knowledge production we see in society today. You have all the technology, you have all the progress on that, but there's something missing. There's a vital dimension missing to all of this knowledge, to all of this instruction, and that vital missing dimension is God's revelation. Revelation from God. Herbert Armstrong often talked about how the Bible is God's instruction manual for mankind, and how that it contains the foundation of all knowledge. It's not the sum total of all knowledge, but it's the foundation. It's the starting point. It's where we begin. God intended for Adam and Eve to go and produce additional knowledge, for sure. But it had to be based on or built upon what's revealed in the Bible. But you know the story there. They rejected God's revelation. They rejected God's truth. And so here we are in the world today, some 6,000 years later. And look at the world. Look at this astonishing paradox. You have all of this material knowledge, this materialistic advancement, and yet man is showing time and time again just how utterly incapable he is of solving even the most basic problems facing our society, facing our world. He doesn't have that foundational knowledge, that spiritual dimension. Let's look over at 1 Corinthians 2 in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul said in his book to Rome, Romans chapter 7, that the law is spiritual. God's law is spiritual. God's truth. It's spiritual. It comes from God. God's law, it's not there telling you how to go and construct an airplane or how to plant a garden, although there's plenty of agricultural principles and instructions in the Bible, for sure. But what God's law teaches, first and foremost, is how to establish a relationship with God and how to have right relationships with other people. That's where it all begins. You have to have a right relationship with your Creator. And you have to know how to get along with fellow man. This is where man has failed. And you see it in families. You see it in religions. You see it in government. You see it in nations. You see it in continents. Mr. Armstrong once said that man can't deal with man, and man doesn't want to deal with God. That's the reality of the world today. We want God out of the equation. We want to shove God out of the picture. And then we go about with all of this proud rhetoric that we have all the solutions, whether we come from the left and the left says this or the right side says this. And the world, meanwhile, continues. It continues to explode in violence, in selfishness, in vanity, in hatred and strife. 1 Corinthians 2 here in verse 9, it says, "But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for him that love him." So it takes a spiritual dimension or understanding to really understand the purpose that God's working out here below. It says, "But God has revealed them unto us by His Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God." See, God reveals His truth. And He reveals it, it says over in Matthew 11 and verse 25, He reveals it to spiritual babes, to those who are teachable, to those who are humble, to those who look to God for instruction. It says in verse 11 here, "For what man knows the things of a man, save the spirit of man, which is in him? Even so, the things of God knows no man but the Spirit of God." The natural mind of man, it can understand material knowledge, but unless it's empowered by God's Holy Spirit, it cannot understand spiritual knowledge. And God's law, as it says in Romans 7, is spiritual. So unless we humble ourselves and repent and turn to God, our minds are not going to be opened to the precious truth revealed in the Holy Bible. Verse 13 says, "Which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual." See, you can't receive spiritual knowledge from a university or a college in this world. You can't receive it from high school. Not unless it's God's school. Not unless it's God's college. This world's cut off from God. You see it in Genesis 3 right there at the end of that chapter. And then you see it in 2 Corinthians 4 and Revelation 12 where it talks about the God of this world deceiving the whole world. Verse 14 says, "But the natural man receives not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned." It takes the Spirit of God, it takes the mind of God in us to understand the things of God. Otherwise, it's just all foolishness. That's what this world thinks about God's truth. It's foolishness. But soon the minds of everyone on earth will be opened to the truth. Everyone in Mystery of the Ages, Herbert Armstrong said this, "Human life is animal existence, but in the form and shape of God, and with the human spirit added to the brain. Man was created to have a relationship with his Maker, Therefore, he was made in his maker's form and shape, with contact and relationship made possible by the presence within him of the human spirit. So we're all equipped with that. It gives us mind power. It gives us the ability to think and to reason. And in using those powers, look at what man's been able to do. And yet without the Spirit of God, look at what man has been unable to do. That's why we see this astonishing paradox. As Romans 8:16 says, the Spirit itself must bear witness with our spirit. God's spirit must fuse together with the human spirit. After one goes through a process of repentance toward God, repentance, belief, or faith, baptism, the laying on of hands, this is all spelled out in, of course, numerous other scriptures. I can't cover it all. But suffice it to say, this astonishing paradox is as it is because of this missing, this vital missing dimension in the knowledge production of man. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. Thank you for staying with me. If you stayed through to the end of this program with me sounding like this, that's a wonderful thing. We appreciate it. We appreciate you listening in every day. Thank you for joining us today. And tomorrow, hopefully, I'll sound a little bit better. See you tomorrow.